My name is Andy Franklin. I'm serving as the moderator for today's panel. It's Friday, April 12th. This is panel number 4304. The subject is artificial intelligence and our society. I think it's a very exciting and timely topic, and we have a fantastic panel here to help us understand the topic. I'll provide a brief introduction of the panel members, and then we'll have allow them each 5 to 10 minutes to express some thoughts on this subject, and then there's some time for them to interact with one another, and then we'll go into the question and answer period from the audience. Questions can be submitted either using the CWA app on your device or with note cards. If you raise your hands, the producers will bring you a note card, and you can write your questions on a note card, and they'll be passed to me, and I'll be trying to curate the questions, and we'll go from there. So let's get started. To my immediate left is William Hertling. William is a science fiction writer and programmer. He was a co-founder and director of engineering at Tripwire, and is a web strategist and software developer at Hewlett-Packard, where he's obtained numerous software engineering patents in areas of networking, protocols, printing, and web applications. He began publishing science fiction in 2011 with Avogadro Core, The Singularity is Closer Than It Appears. He's been influenced by Ray Kurzweil and Charles Stross, and his work examines the emergence of strong artificial intelligence and how humankind reacts and coexists with AI. Next, we have Waleed Kaddous. Is an engineering leader with strong research and practical engineering skills. He is interested in using technology to make people's lives more productive and satisfying. He currently works at Uber, where he's helped riders and drivers find each other by improving location, direction, and maps. Prior to Uber, he worked at Google on Google Maps, Google X, and Android. He's conducted research on systems that recognize sign language, find victims in disaster sites, and develop smart sensing to assist the elderly in being independent. And finally, my far left is Alexander Bard. Alexander is a philosopher and futurologist based in Stockholm, Sweden. He's written many books, but three of which are collectively known as the Futuric Trilogy. And he worked together with media theorist Jan Soderquist. Bard has enjoyed a highly successful 25-year career as a producer and artist in the international music industry. And he is a celebrity in his native Sweden as the toughest judge on the TV show Swedish Idol and Sweden's Got Talent. I asked him if that was true because I found it a little surprising, but he says it is true. So with that, let's get started. We'll start with William.
Thank you. Thanks all of you for being here. The room is packed. This is great. Lots of people are interested in AI these days. So I got my start writing science fiction with a book called Avogadro Core, which I wanted to look at what happens when we have AI in society. Historically, the kinds of questions we ask about AI is, is it alive or not? Does it have rights or not? Is it going to kill us all or not? And I thought there was a lot more to explore than just that. And so I wrote a whole series of books spaced at 10-year intervals to look at what happens to society over time and what kinds of social issues do we have, what kind of benefits do we get, and how do we coexist with them, eventually another sentient species. I thought I would just spend a few moments talking about what we mean by AI, because we're going to spend a whole panel talking about that, and I figured I would just briefly mention that we generally talk about two kinds of AI, weak AI or narrow AI, and that's the kind of things that a self-driving car would be considered narrow AI. It solves a specific problem, how to make the car go down the road. It's a very complex problem, but you're not going to have a conversation with your car while you're doing it. The other type of AI is stronger general AI, and historically, like, this is what we hear about in science fiction, right? We are thinking about like Data from Star Trek, or Terminator movies, right? The AI is reasoning; it's it's out there. You can talk to it, and it's out to kill you. Not all the general AI is out to kill you. Narrow AI is what we're likely to have for the next 10 to 30 years, although we may talk more about that and debate that. And there's some debate over whether we'll ever have general AI, but I think there's a sizable contingent of people who think it will happen, and it's somewhere 10 to 30 years out. What was I going to say about that? You know, one of the questions of the panel was, you know, is there a positive social disruption? I'm sure we're going to get into this in a lot more detail, but I thought I would just talk about car sharing as an example, and I'm sure Wally's going to talk a lot more about it. But car sharing is this great example of a platform where we're increasing the resource utilization of cars that are out there so that we could, in theory, have an order of magnitude less cars, right? Cars represent a sunk material cost, energy, storage, all these issues. And as a society, right, sustainability, our footprint on the planet, is a really big deal. So the ability for AI to help us get people from point A to point B with less resources is an absolutely phenomenal positive social benefit. But also, 5% of jobs in the United States involve driving vehicles from one place to another. And all of those may disappear at some point in the near future when all vehicles are autonomous. And that comes with benefits, right? You know, there are 3,000 people a day die in automotive accidents, and self-driving cars could do that better and avoid the vast majority of those fatalities. That is a great benefit to society. We'll see more energy efficiency. But at this, and you know, honestly, like a job sitting driving a car 10 hours a day isn't super healthy for your body or your mind. So we might prefer to not have to force people to do those kinds of jobs. But what's different about AI compared to any other technology, right? There's always been fears about technology and how it's going to eliminate jobs. So, you know, the cotton gin was, you know, fear that it's going to lead to the loss of all the jobs. Well, other jobs come around, right? Technology leads to new kinds of opportunities, which create new kinds of employment. Employment has generally risen. But the difference with AI is that it's a piece of technology that crosses so many spectrums and solves so many different kinds of problems. It's not just that driving jobs go away. It's that driving jobs and a whole bunch of other menial jobs go away. And we may have mass unemployment. How do we deal with that? So, the flip side.
Thank you. Waleed?
Well, thank you very much. It's a complete pleasure to be here. I've had a blast so far. This is my first CWA, and I'll be doing everything I can to see if I can come back to the next one. The audiences are wonderful. It's just, it's been a blast. So what I do, my day job is I am basically a futurist for Uber. I look at emerging technologies that are 2 to 4 years out, and of course AI is the big one. AI is the change that's really almost every aspect of modern life is going to be touched by AI. So today I'm more in a personal capacity rather than representing Uber. But as I approach this panel and we ask the question of how AI fits in society, I really came to two questions. The first one is, overall, does AI contribute more to society than it takes away? Is it a positive sum? And that's the first question. The second question I had is, if it is a positive sum, then how do we ensure that the benefits of that are distributed evenly and fairly through society? Because if you're not careful, technologies like AI can disadvantage some and advantage others. And we're already starting to see signs of that. So on the first question, I thought about it, and the answer to me, with one exception, was unconditionally yes. Like, I really feel that AI is a technology that has brought us so many benefits. It has literally saved lives. One of the areas I study is car safety. And forward collision warning systems, which are based on AI that detect pedestrians moving in front of them, in one study it was found that it saved reduced impact to passengers by 35%. This is AI really saving lives. Every time you pull your phone out and you do a Google search, that's AI. When we try to make Uber run efficiently, that's AI. When your Fitbit tells you how much you've walked that day, that's using AI. It's already ingrained in our society. So many little of the different pieces that we involve just AI is already built into them. And so overall, you know, that's without talking about fields like medicine and engineering and all of these fields. It's really having this very universal impact. The one exception to this, in my opinion, is lethal applications of AI. And this is something that, personally, I am deeply, deeply concerned about. And that comes from my research history. Early on when I started in AI, this is like two decades ago, so, you know, one of my colleagues jokes that, you know, I was working on AI before it had commercial applications, right? So now it's obvious, but at the time I was working on a robot that we could deploy into disaster sites. So these are robots about yay big that, imagine you have a collapsed building. You drive this robot in side to create a map of the building, identifying where victims are, so then a human rescuer can follow up and can pull that person out of the disaster site. Ultimately, you'd like to get to the robots themselves saving people, but that's a little further away. But at the same time, I thought about this technology and realized, wait, with a very simple modification, with minimal technical changes, this same technology could be used in lethal ways to send a robot into a building to hurt someone rather than to save someone. And the other thing that really impacted me in terms of the concerns about the lethal applications of AI was there's a very famous AI researcher. His name is Stuart Russell. And he worked with a group who put together this video called Slaughterbots. And what this showed was small drones that can be modified for lethal intent. So imagine that you have one of those remote control drones, but it has a camera on it, and it uses face identification to identify its victims. If you haven't seen the video, it's worth looking up. Just search for Slaughterbots. And for me as a practitioner of AI, the big problem for me is I looked at that and I knew that, you know, give me a year and four engineers and I could build that for you. That proximity and that potential risk from the poor application of AI was also like a huge concern to me. And that's what we need to put mechanisms to deal with. Coming back to the social justice aspects of AI and making sure that those things are addressed, I think that the concerns are twofold. The first concern is the benefit of AI equally applied? And we've already seen that some of the algorithms that companies use to select resumes when they get 3 million applicants have been shown to have bias in some cases. Those situations, I think we will see an evolution. And as a practitioner in the field, you know, at one of the top conferences, NIPS, there's already a study called Fair Machine Learning that's trying to modify the algorithms to get rid of that bias. But the part that I don't know the answer to, and I'm hoping to hear from my panelist, is what about the impact on people's lives in terms of, you can think of this AI as bringing a surplus to society, but how do we help the people who will lose their jobs? How do we ensure that people still have meaning in the absence of work? If AI is bringing a surplus, can we redistribute it and look at things like a universal basic income that benefits from those from the surplus that is brought by all of the improvements in efficiency and farming and everything that will come with AI? And that's the question for me that I'm most concerned about for the future of AI. With that, I'll hand over to Alex.
I love your brother. I knew you would say universal basic income, okay? There's one example of that already being applied in the world. It's called Saudi Arabia. Go to Saudi Arabia and then look at Saudi Arabian residents in their own country. They all have diabetes, they're fat, they die before they're 29. Life without work is meaningless. There you go. So, why I'm here as a philosopher is that I want to take a bigger perspective. So, let's go to China. The vast majority of innovation right now in this area is happening in China, not in America. China is racing away from America at a fast speed. I don't even use the term AI because I think it's degrading to humans. I say symbiotic intelligence because that is man and machine in a relationship with each other. Well, machines are supposed to do what we are not very good at. For example, loving strangers. We're not very good at that as human beings. If machines can help us with that, great. Then I'm all for the machines. But symbiotic intelligence is a term we use in philosophy. It's the relationship between man and machine because we are going to be very different as humans in this whole new environment. With all these machine intelligence around us everywhere, we already know it because you spend like 6 hours a day staring at smartphones and laptops already now. That means you're immersed in digital. That means you live in the digital world already. Boulder is like a second address now. The number one address is your Facebook account, right? You already live in digital. What's going to happen now with an augmented world where machine intelligence is prevalent everywhere is that everything's going to change. So what are the Chinese doing about this? Well, they have something called the Chinese Communist Party. And they have by far the biggest data cloud the world has ever seen. That means anything that passes through Chinese territory, anything close to Chinese interest whatsoever, will send its data off to the Chinese Communist Party. So their dream is to create something they call censocracy. A censocracy is a society where there are censors absolutely everywhere that map everything that everybody does, meaning the Chinese Communist Party can figure out not only that you have an opinion that's different from theirs, they can figure it out even before you have it. And they hit you and take you out. You're laughing at this. If you go to China today and sit down in Shanghai in a hotel room and try to order a flight ticket, and suddenly you can't buy the flight ticket because the social credit system is China's punishing you for being different from the Chinese communist norm. They don't understand the horrors that are happening here. This is the nightmare in China. Now take it to America. Number one, the American dream is dead. You don't have a shared narrative in this country any longer. You have a flag, and that's all you have. And some people are going to erase the flag, and some people are going to burn the flag the next 5-10 years. You think it's all going to be about the flag, because you don't have a dream any longer in this country. So go to Charlottesville. That seems marginal today. Charlottesville was Antifa on one side, and it was the social justice warriors on the other side. Okay, but these guys love each other, because they're two different cults that are taking over this country. It's called Trump and Clinton in the more grown-up version. America is now split, 50% against 50%. And even at this conference, there's so many degrading words being said about Trump voters. They don't give much hope for Americans if this is the way you treat your other citizens of your country. Okay? Now, that means these guys are going to sit in places like Portland, Oregon, to be hipsters, and they're going to build bombs. They're going to put them on drones, because internet recipes exist already for how you make your own bombs. And then you put them on a drone, and you send them into, say, Michigan. And then in Michigan, you're going to have white heterosexual guys who are hated by social justice warriors, disappointed with Trump for not building the factories that he promised. What are they going to do? They're going to build bombs. Because if you've got a lot of 20-year-old men in this society who have no purpose and meaning in their life, you get phenomena like Islamism in the Middle East. You're going to get phenomena like Antifa and social justice warriors in America. And these guys are going to go to bombs next, because bombs are going to be so easy to make. And drones are going to be prevalently available everywhere, because machine intelligence will be yours too. Now, when these guys start throwing bombs at each other, what do you think Americans are going to do then? You're going to look to China, because they're not going to have those bombs, because they've got the Chinese Communist Party ruling everything. You're going to get exactly what you did after the French Revolution in 1789. After 11 years of bloodbath and chaos, Napoleon stepped into the scene and said, "Give me all power." And people gladly did. You're going to end up with a very authoritarian American. And I see this as unavoidable, because in California, we got little boys dreaming about a perfect Platonist world, about going to Mars. What the fuck are you going to do on Mars? You're going to save this planet, right? There's nothing there. It's cold and full of radiation. You can go to Siberia, it's warmer, and there's nobody there. These are little boys with little boys' minds. They've never studied philosophy. They've never studied psychology. They've never studied art. They don't understand the other half of intelligence, which is humans. Now, if you sit with your little machines, you've got little dreams, you create companies like Facebook, and Facebook employed thousands of psychologists to train Facebook customers to become addicted to Facebook. That's evil. And they didn't run a customer service. If I got blocked from Facebook for saying the wrong word or something, and I was thrown off Facebook for 30 days, I didn't have anybody to call who could tell me why that happened. And the reason why they did that is that Facebook said, "No, it's too costly to run a fucking customer service." When I'm just like, well, you deserve 1.5 million people leaving Facebook now a month. Because human beings are healthy. They know their own self-interest. And they realize that Facebook is nothing but an addiction machine. It has no value for humans, and we leave. This is the bigger picture. Yes, this is going to revolutionize the world. And my God, when I walk out in Boulder with this smartphone, 3 years ago, it would have given me 10 restaurants at night that I could pick between. These days, Google Maps gives me one restaurant, because they know me so well, and they know my budget, and they know my interest, and I'm so tired of vegan food, I want a steak. Okay, so I get a steak restaurant, Central Boulder, and then the smartphone tells me, get your fat ass over there, sit down and have the meal, and we take the profit, right? That is what machine intelligence does already. It's going to revolutionize the world. And we're going to be so mesmerized by all the magic it adds to us. But besides authoritarianism, this is going to benefit, say, 20% of the population. They're going to fly. They're going to move to places like Dubai and Singapore and the Cayman Islands and make tons of money. And they're going to own tech companies and going to rule the world. That's the 15-20% at best are going to be the new superior superclass. But for 80% of the population of this country, this is a nightmare waiting you. Thank you.
All right. You got a little passion going here on the subject.
You better.
I know there's at least one debate we can have about universal basic income between Khalid and Alex. So why don't we start?
So I mean, just to, and I know this is peripheral to AI, but I think we do have to consider this, right? So although Alex points out that universal basic income has failed, let's just say that the jury's out. So I was just quickly looking it up and talking about the Finland experiment, and I'm just going to read one last part of it. It says they had no change in how many of them worked. They had more trust in other people and social institutions, showed more faith in their ability to have influence in their own life, in their personal finances, and in their prospects of finding employment. So that's the finding from the Finland study. So, I mean, we may want to kind of move back to the discussion on AI, but I do think things like universal basic income deserve some experimentation to see if it does do things. And I think to simplify the situation in Saudi Arabia about to those small number of variables when it's a very complex, nuanced culture that's still struggling with its transfer to modernity is kind of a little oversimplifying, to be direct.
Okay, I can respond to that right away, because look at the Finland survey too. Yeah, you will, right away, right after me, because I just want to correct that. The Finland survey, if you only ask people what they said, they say nice things. That's what people always do when they get a survey, because they don't want to offend anybody. Then look at the rate of alcoholism in the area of Finland. We introduced universal basic income, and it flew through the roof. Okay, it's not that easy, okay? People want to contribute, and if you get money without contributing, you go and kill yourself. Because you have no human value left.
There are contributions beyond money. And that's the other problem I have with your hypothesis. But
So what I'm going to say is that universal basic income has to do with the redistribution of wealth, which is an entirely separate question from whether or not there will be jobs. Mm-hmm. There will not be jobs, period. So when there are not jobs, then you have a question of, do you redistribute wealth to people, or do you just let people die? Maybe you just proactively kill them off. But the point is the jobs won't be there. Whether or not you have universal basic income or not, the jobs won't be there. So that has to be faced. And then we have to deal with the fact that we as a society don't know how to live when we don't have jobs. So it's not that universal basic income is the problem. The problem is defining meaning in life. And that takes a certain skill set. And there are people who can find meaning in life. There are plenty of people here, I'm sure, who if they had no job tomorrow, they would be very happy, and they would find lots of interesting things to do. Mm. And then there would be a very large pool of people, and including people who exist today, who are in the situation where they're underemployed or unemployed, and they're unhappy, right? And lots of people are there today. Even if you're employed, that is an imperfect solution to finding meaning. So this question of how do we find meaning, what does it mean to be human, what drives us, how do we find purpose, how do we find pleasure, right? We need to solve that, and we can't just watch television 16 hours a day.
I agree completely with you, William. And this is exactly what I'm talking about. Narrative, like a shared story. America desperately needs a new one. And also contribution. Contributive role to society. If you want to find a place in America today where people are going and killing themselves out of meaninglessness, it's called West Virginia. You've got an opioid epidemic in this country. America is now the only country in the world where the average lifespan is falling. It's been falling for the past 4 years. You're getting close to 100,000 opioid abuse deaths per year in America. Go to damn West Virginia. Get your fat asses over there. Sit down with those people and look into their lives, and it's completely meaningless. Trump is not going to build the factories he promised. We all know that. Now, the question is, are they either going to kill themselves with opioids, which the Chinese make, it's called fentanyl. It's the most evil innovation ever in human history. You know, your whole life supply of fentanyl fits into your pocket. Okay? Are we going to allow them to just kill themselves? Or are we going to address the problem that this is going to spread wider and wider into society? My guess is that about 80% of the population are likely to become West Virginians when they get some money in their hand even and have no purpose with their lives. We need to re-understand what it means to be human. Douglas Rushkoff is doing an amazing project in America right now called Team Human. Check that out as well. I think he's really healthy because he's also pissed off with Silicon Valley for being too autistic and too Asperger's syndrome oriented right now. We need to understand what it means to be human in a new fundamental way. This means going back all the way back to Aristotle and study what does it mean to be human. We don't need a new enlightenment. That's what Silicon Valley wants. We need a new renaissance. A new fundamental understanding of humans, art, psychology, social theory, all those things, so that we then can create the story that William is talking about.
Although I would argue that there's a large percentage, not a large, that there are people who are self-actualized. There are people who are living an intentional life today who are quite satisfied with their life. They may have checked out of mainstream society. They may have done a lot of things. We actually, I think, know what it means to be human. We know how to live as human beings. That knowledge is not evenly distributed, right? And that is really the biggest issue. The 80% of Americans who may all turn to opioids, they don't have knowledge, they don't have that access, they don't have that exposure. So how do we get them access to that? And maybe AI is part of that. Maybe it's improving the kind of information people have. Maybe it's improving the kinds of experiences people have.
So I really want to, like, the West Virginia thing bothers me a bit, because I think we don't really understand. I think that there's this immense set of people that, if given the opportunity, given the breathing space to you know, where they don't have to worry on a day-to-day basis where their food is coming from, if we can take that pressure off them, how many more awesome people could we find by taking that pressure off them? And so it's not clear to me if the West Virginia issue is because people feel, there's just no hope, or it's because they face so much pressure just trying to sustain themselves that they have very few outlets, right? And simplifying it to this kind of simple, that's why they take fentanyl or opiates, just doesn't tell the whole story. Now, what AI gives us a tool to do is it allows us to maybe look at options where there's going to be so much, there's going to be a surplus beyond the basic needs of every human being, and I have a reasonable expectation that that's the case, that we have the opportunity to address their needs. And really, that's the beauty of the opportunity of AI for me.
That's exactly what the Chinese would say. The Chinese would say, let's go to West Virginia, put sensors absolutely everywhere, register what these people do, then look down on them like if we knew better what they want. I think the West Virginians are humans and intelligent. Human intelligence, remember, there's something called that, right? I think they're actually prophetic. I think the reaction is healthy. I think the reaction is a signal that something is fundamentally wrong with society. I sit down all day as a scientist to see these people and talk to them so that I can hear their story. I sit down with teenage girls who have eating disorders. That's signaling. If a teenage girl has eating disorders because she's so damn bullied on Instagram, so she starts hating her own body, that is a signal that something is wrong with the system. It's not human any longer. I sit down with guys, with men between 20 and 30, have enormous problems today with bipolarity. Bipolarity is a pandemic in our society among men between 20 and 30. I think that's a signal. That's healthy. When West Virginians are killing themselves with opioids, we have to understand that that's a healthy sign that something is fundamentally, pathologically wrong with our society. So instead of looking down on them, like if they can just get food on the table, they do have food on the table. It's called hamburgers. America's full of it. McDonald's are everywhere, and they make them obese by feeding them bad food constantly. You know, obesity is not an epidemic. Obesity is a signal that something is fundamentally wrong with the society, where people are so infantile they can't stop eating. That in itself is a signal. All these things are, to me as a philosopher, signals of a system that has run away from what it means to be human and needs to catch up with that so that we tame the machines to do what we need. And I get one thing the machines should do for us, which is fiendishly difficult. And that is for the Antifa guy and for the social justice warrior to like each other, at least like each other. And it's for American and Chinese people to love each other. You're never going to love the Chinese, and they're never going to love you. But the machines with blockchains, everything we got out there, decentralized platforms, could help you with that. That, I think, we should give the order to the machine intelligence developers that this is the number one priority. Because otherwise, we're all going to go tribal, go into our own little loops, and then start throwing bombs at each other.
Okay. On that hopeful note, I'll start taking questions.
Questions about AI.
questions about AI. Well, questions about the AI and society. And I have some good ones here. Let me start with this one. As machines recognize human emotions, i.e. empathy, love, compassion, and shame and hate from observations and surveys, why can't they replicate our sense of fairness, conscious, without being conscious?
So maybe I can give a technical answer at least on that particular aspect. So yes, machines are getting amazingly good at reading emotions. In fact, there are things called micro facial expressions that we as humans can't pick up that machines, with their ability to look at 60 images a second and process them, can. Right. So there's a possibility of even superhuman emotion recognition. Right. The problem is no one really understands emotions well enough. The essence of programming is to understand a problem well enough that you can design it from scratch. And the reality is no one has a deep enough understanding of how emotions really work and how notions like fairness really work in a way that it is easy to program a computer to arrive at right now. That's just the limitations of the technology. And there's even a philosophical objection. Like, to some extent, machines that we design will always reflect our own patterns, right? There's already the issues, the biases that AI algorithms show are reflecting the biases of humans. If a human designs a fairness system, it will reflect the fairness system of a human. And just like there's no universal notion of fairness, there's no way to build a computer that can be fairer than any human group could define fairness, if that makes sense.
That doesn't mean that it can't approach and work toward fairness, right? In the same way that we can use a recommendation algorithm to pick out a restaurant based upon what our own preferences are, a machine can approach the prediction of what we would consider fair, right? A machine can look at our behaviors, what we consider fair, and then work towards how do you optimize that outcome, right? We're still far from that, but that could be where we're going.
Yeah. And so, for example, if you want to check that a computer does not have gender bias or race bias, there are ways that we could approach that. Those are the areas where it's well-defined, but there's more nuance to those areas, and there are many other areas where, like, anywhere you can define something crisply, there's a shot at a computer doing it.
Okay, I'm not sure I want any of this, to be honest about it. Number one thing with digital is that memory is going to be huge. It's machinic from now on. Everything that happens from now on in our lives will be memorized. It cannot be eradicated. I mean, if you think that Google actually throw away the Gmail when you throw it away, they don't. Okay? Everything is now memory from now on. That means everything we did in our entire lives was memorized. That means if you were drunk and you were 15 years old, somebody can run up to you when you're 60 years old and accuse you of what you did when you were 15 and eternally condemn you for it. That's exactly what's happening in media today already. This is a major problem. The art of forgetting was fundamental to human society before. So you got a sentence, you were sent to jail for, say, a couple of years. Once you got out of jail, you were forgiven. You had a clean sheet. You can start your life again. Not any longer. You get sentenced to 2 years in jail, and then you're on the map forever, like you're this nasty guy who did this nasty thing once in your life. And what kind of zombies and robots do we as humans have to be to sort of fulfill and live up to this idea that we're perfect and never make mistakes? All of this is incredibly inhuman. And we already have these social media lynch mobs today running around all over Instagram and the internet, running after anybody who said the wrong word somewhere and had the wrong etiquette and didn't let the right person speak when it was that person's time to speak. You know, it's becoming like a Versailles of madness, a Versailles of tonality, etiquette, different little things out there that can be offended if you say the wrong thing. And everything will be memorized. So if you make one tiny mistake according to the current etiquette now, 20 years ago, you're doomed forever. That is contemporary society. This is madness to me, but it's already happening. And this is already a relationship between man and machine that we're not even seeing as a man-machine relationship. Now, if we're going to live a society where everything from now on will always be remembered, we better start thinking about things like grace and mercy, you know? Confession booths, right? You are forgiven. It's not eradicated, but it's okay. It's warts and all, right? And machines will not do that for us. That, again, has to be a human thing we do.
Okay. I'm trying to listen and filter through all the many questions I've gotten that are good. Here's an interesting one, I think. Unlike most of the audience, I grew up immersed in digital technology and metabolized the idea of technological innovation as unequivocally beneficial. How do I retroactively reassess this worldview?
go ahead.
As somebody who sort of grew up online from the time I was 16, right? I mean, this is the same thing. Like, to me, I was spending all of my time in online chat systems when I was a teenager. I'd go hang out with the same friends in person afterwards. When the 90s came along, I got to chat with people on the internet, and I could find people who had shared interests no matter where they were in the world, no matter what time zone they were in. So to me, it's all been a history of positive stuff. We get to social media, and I'm like, this is my heyday. Like, we are building systems for everything I ever imagined. And for anybody who's, you know, shy or inhibited in any way, like, the ability to be able to have a conversation and be anonymous or at least have protection of your machine, like, you can have all kinds of conversations you wouldn't have otherwise. There's lots and lots of reasons why it's good. But anything taken to excess can turn around and hit a point where it's not good. And we now can see lots and lots of negative side effects of social media. There have been many benefits. There still are many benefits. But we can't just live our lives online mediated by a screen. I've told the story on a few panels now, but I went through a breakup last summer. And I had... I was depressed, as one is, right, after these things, and I'm down in the dumps, and I'm chatting with a bunch of friends online, and I spent my whole day chatting with those friends, and at the end of the day, I'm still depressed, right? It didn't really make a dent in that. But that night, a friend came over to borrow something. He was at my house for about, like, 45 minutes. We're talking face-to-face, and we're just, you know, shooting the shit. We're talking about the same stuff I was chatting with him online about all day long, but 45 minutes in person, face-to-face, and I felt better, right? I felt happy. We need those kinds of moments to be able to have insight into the world. We need to create those opportunities for ourselves to get offline, to interact with people. And it's hard. I also told this story in another panel about how when I was younger, I used to be like intensely dissatisfied with the car that I had, and I didn't understand why. And then I'd be like okay with the car that I had, and then I'd be unhappy with the car that I had, and I'd have to buy a new one. And I realized it was Car and Driver magazine showing up on my doorstep once a month. And then for a week, I'd be really unhappy. Well, the difference between that and today is that that magazine only showed up once a month. Whereas today, it's very hard to get outside the system. How many of you have spent 3 weeks off of your phone? Right? It hasn't happened. So you're always there. You can't get outside the system in order to see the influence that it's having on you. So you have to try to create those kinds of moments however you can. You know, if you're a parent, that means, like, having time when your kids don't have their phones, right, even though they have pressure for it. If you're an adult, it means go somewhere where you're off the grid and there's no connection to the internet. Go do something in the real world. Like, we can create these moments, and we have to do it in order to be able to see the effect of the system on us.
I think when we look at technology, there's something special about AI, and that is that it is the ultimate dual-use technology, right? It is this technology that can be used for good and evil. And what that means is that if there's any kind of social crack, any kind of underlying social issue, AI provides a way for us, provides a mechanism to amplify that, right? So just to play off one example, like one example of... That's very obvious to us now is the role of AI and in propagating extremism, right? Like that's it seems so simple, but whether it's extremism on the Islamic side, I myself am a Muslim, just to be clear, or on the white supremacist side, we see how AI and the fact that you click on one video and then the next video and then the next video and the next video, and they kind of take you down a rabbit hole. So we have stories of people like seeing one extremist video and then click on the next one. And that selection is made by an AI, right? So this what I see happening, and this is why we have to think about this and, like, take an observational perspective on the history of technology. This is not something new. Nuclear power had the same issues, right? The question is, how do we those things are going to happen. And it's naive to assume that any technology will not take the social issues of the day and in some way have a complex interaction with them, usually amplifying and accelerating them.
I agree completely. I would just say the social justice warriors are doing exactly the same thing. They go into their silo, further down the rabbit hole too. So what we are creating then is a society with these silos. And these silos have no connection with each other any longer. And there's technologies available where you can cause havoc in the opposite silo. And if you're the guy who caused havoc in the opposite silo, you get popular in the first one. I'll give you a perfect example of this we use in this last book, Digital Libido. We followed a 27-year-old guy who lived in Birmingham, UK. He was a bit of a fat kid, a bit of an outsider. Computer games and a little internet porn, that was his life. Quite miserable, didn't get laid, not good with the girls, right? He's 27 years old, and he's sitting there, and he discovers there's something called Quran for Dummies online. He reads it, takes him about 2 days to become a Muslim fundamentalist. He then goes off in a flight to Southeast Turkey, one-way ticket, low-cost airline, takes a bus across the border into Syria, and 2 days later, he gets to cut the neck of a guy he hates, a British soldier. And then he gets laid. Now, that's completely understandable why that guy did that, because that was his only option to get purpose and meaning and get laid. So this can happen in America. It can happen to anybody. It's completely universal. And the deeper we go into these silos, these rabbit holes, that will happen. But moralizing against the silos is not going to work. I can't moralize against a social justice warrior because he goes into an algorithm that makes him hate white supremacists even more and be a bigger fan of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or whatever. That's one extreme, right? Or be a fan of white supremacists going into another silo. It's just that I see society where these silos are not being built. The only way out of that historically is to build a shared narrative. Okay, let's go back to the bloodiest part of human history ever. That was the first 1,000 years of permanent settlements in the river valleys, about between 6,000 and 5,000 years ago. When the first permanent settlements happened, it was because written language had arrived, but nobody knew what was going on. So that was chaos. So literally, if you had a village in Mesopotamia along the river, your tribe had settled there, and you got into starvation, you would just go down the river and kill all the guys in the next one, and then take all, rape and pillage, take everything back to your village. It's incredibly bloody. Now, what the priests did eventually was that the priests in the different tribes realized that we need to unify and create a shared narrative. And these were the first ritual places in history, big ritual places. These were the first cities in history. They were called ziggurats. They built ritual places, and basically, I would walk up one stair here, on one side of the ziggurat, and another guy from the other tribe would be the priest from their tribe. He'd walk up here, and they walk up to the top and said, okay, you got a god called John in your tribe here, and we got a god called Michael in our tribe here. And we sat down at the drawing board and discovered it's actually the same guy, just two different names, and his name is God. That was the beauty of religion, because the beauty of religion can then be a narrative that people from different silos, it's the same thing all over again, can share. And then you can trade, you can train a warrior into becoming a trader. Don't kill the stranger, trade with him, right? The only way we're going to get these guys now out of these digital silos is by creating that narrative again. The whole thing has to be done all over again. And that's exactly why I'm desperate to get more people out there who try to create that grand narrative that, for example, the American dream used to be. Because that dream's dead. We need new dreams. We need new narratives. We need new directions. Postmodernism is going to kill us because it says we cannot have grand narratives. That in itself is a terrible narrative. You must not dream. It's a terrible narrative. Because without dreams and a direction of where we're going to go and exodus into the digital, there's not going to be a lot of people who can go into that digital world. That is what we need to work on now. AI is nothing but the tool to do that. Let's use the machines to support us in that work. That is what the priest recommend us to do with machine intelligence today. Not work against humans.
There's merit to what you're saying, but the flip side of that is that we cannot recreate the 1950s American dream. Unless what we want is a white heterosexual society.
Exactly. It's dead. It's dead. We can't recreate it.
Right. But the point is like the fracture of the narrative has enabled subcultures to flourish in which people are welcome to be themselves. And I don't think we want to lose that, right? That is valuable. So how do we enable healthy fracturing of a narrative, so we can get the ability for people to be who they want to be. And
perfect question. If you and I would walk up these cigarette stairs and declare that there's a shared guy here called God, do we diminish any of the interests of any of the guys downstairs? Down the stairs? No, we don't. We tell them that you've got to be period of peace now. You can prosper. You can grow stuff. You can tame plants and animals. You can have more children that will survive. I think this is ultimately, it is always this narrative, the exodus out of Egypt, you know, that was the birth of the nation state. It starts with the nation of Israel. And the exodus out of Babylon. All these exodus we had in history has always been, this is the exodus to digital I'm talking about. And America, this has to be a global story. It must not be nationalist to begin with. Because that would be a story that unites the Chinese and the Americans too. The overall bigger story for which all the smaller stories trickle down. And that's when you can say to the guy, stay in your silo, thrive in it, but now we're connecting the silo peacefully with another silo. That's what we're not doing today at all. We don't see the seriousness of the situation.
All right, let me try to take this in a little bit different direction. It's all incredible. But here's a good question, I think. How do we or should we regulate or tax companies that move more and more jobs to automation and AI?
That's an interesting question. I think there are things in our system that encourage us to automate. And it might be worth us considering, and I know Alex will probably differ with me on this, but let's imagine that you have a human cooking. And we decide to replace that human with a robot, right? One of the possibilities, right now for the human, you pay a payroll tax, right? You have, because that human's employed, we pay him a wage. But once you have the robot that's doing exactly the same role, funnily enough, our model changes and it's like, well, that's a machine, you don't pay payroll tax. Even though the reason that we pay payroll tax is to support society, to help make sure that those who are disadvantaged get resources, in some way the robot is fulfilling that role. So it's a question worth considering is, are there ways to tax AI? Now, the big downside is, how do you make this global, right? Because you have such a competitive environment. But there might be mechanisms where a more stable society allows for that. Like in the Scandinavian countries, there's obviously way higher taxation than there is in here in the United States. It doesn't necessarily mean that society isn't happy. And so I think that it's worth us considering mechanisms where there is automation for us to redistribute some of that AI surplus. It's extremely controversial, and I'm not an expert in the field, but I think it at least warrants experimentation and study.
I agree with you. And the thing is, if you can't tax, that's a problem. Anything you can move to another country, you can't tax any longer. So that's the problem.
Well,
it's a lot easier to move robots to Ukraine than it is to move people. That is going to be the problem.
Well, the food will still be local, right? Like, yeah, if you have a restaurant here in the United States, there's nothing that makes it possible.
So on the regulation side, right now I would say, investments in developing artificial intelligence is up here. Investment in the safety mechanisms for artificial intelligence is down here, maybe down here on the floor, actually. There's all kinds of safety. There's the safety when we're turning over our infrastructure to AI. Do we have a set of manual controls? What do we do if the systems break down? Can we land the plane manually if the AI fails? These are issues, right, that are facing us today. If our cars are all self-driving and one morning we wake up and they don't drive, for whatever reason, a computer virus, they don't want to drive, anything, do we have a steering wheel and a gas pedal? Can we still drive the car without the computer? Sometimes, there have been countless cases of applications and services that go away someday, and then you end up with a defunct device because, the company that was behind that device doesn't exist and the cloud infrastructure has gone away. Now you have a dead device. If Tesla collapses, will your Tesla keep driving tomorrow? I don't know the answer to that, and maybe Tesla doesn't either. So there's investment that we have to make into risk mitigation for these things, into redundancy, into backups. And that's an area where I think we could have some success in regulating, where we can say, hey, if you whatever your budget is for AI development, you need to have 5% of it be into risk mitigation and redundancy, or something that's workable as a society. That, I think, would yield some positive results.
And you actually answered the question, because the more resilient systems you create, also for the entrepreneurs, the more likely they are to pay tax. The more they can see the fit, that's exactly what Scandinavia's high taxes. You go back to the corporate sector every year and say, this is all the value we create for you with educated workers, safety systems, trust between citizens, etc., that makes it easy for you to run a company, but pay your damn tax. So that William actually answered that question. But it's very complicated. And what you said, though, is really interesting. You said this has to be on a global level to work. Okay, United Nations doesn't have a narrative, does it? That we all hate it. So, again, that means we need a global narrative, shared narrative between Chinese and Americans and everybody in between, that this is something good for everybody. And we haven't even gotten started creating that narrative yet.
All right. I've had a few questions on this subject. And that is, how can AI help solve climate change or the crisis of climate change? Can you think of ways that could be applied
I think it's necessary. I think we cannot solve climate change without machine intelligence. I would say that definitely. Again, because it also requires loyalty across the entire planet for these systems to be implemented. I would say what I'm working on right now at a team is that we're working on a perspective that's more like climate balance. Why not take a 30 to 40,000 year perspective instead and say, how do we avoid the next ice age? Because we're going to stay 10 billion people on this planet, hopefully not more. Then we have to avoid the next ice age. Because then if you take that perspective, again about direction and vision, if you take a perspective, say, 30,000 years ahead, suddenly solving current climate change problems becomes a much smaller issue in a larger picture. And you get a direction for where you're going to develop the technology. That's what I would answer, yeah.
I think one of the benefits of AI is it's allowed more efficient use of resources. One example is motor vehicles, right? If for example, vehicles are used more than the 96% that they currently stay idle, that's all of the manufacturing and contributions that have been saved from like making another car, right? At the same time, if that vehicle is electric and is bringing a lot of benefits in that way, if we can direct that vehicle to be more efficient, if we can do freight shipments, for example, more efficiently, because we know that we can fill them with loads in both directions instead of having what's called a deadhead, where you just have an empty vehicle, right? Then that already is starting to help. Now, that's the immediate. Longer term is accelerating the research process, right? So when there are all these kinds of chemicals or technological approaches that we could be exploring to help us tackle climate change, right? AI can help develop those. Already one of the applications of AI is to help design chemicals that have particularly desirable properties that might help with, say, carbon sequestration or finding some kind of reaction that would happen to tackle them. So I think in terms of being a tool for accelerating research in approaches, I think that's the other one. So, yeah.
I disagree with that one.
Did you want to add something?
No.
Okay. We speak about AI and the elimination of jobs as an inevitability, but that is only true if you prioritize profit over human well-being. How can we shape a future with AI doing what it does well and humans being freed up to do what we do uniquely well, relate, care for one another, find meaning in relationships and connections? Maybe we've talked a little bit about this, but I wonder if you have any other thoughts.
Well, we are tribal creatures. And we find meaning through our social connections. And if we're lucky and we have terrible health or anything like that, we'd like to contribute. It's fundamentally human to like to contribute. That's why I'm talking about contribution all the time, so we don't get stuck with the employment, unemployment, job issue. Because contribution can be a lot of other things than jobs. But as jobs are constructed today, with employment and everything, that has been the easiest way to tell somebody you contribute to society because you've got a job, you make money for yourself, take care of yourself, take care of your family, you pay taxes. Okay. Oh, great, I'm a citizen, right? Now, we need to reinvent that, definitely, but I don't think we can fake it. I think anything that tries to fake it, like we give you money, off you go, do your own thing. Well, that's good for you if you're an artist and you have tons of time to explore creativity and you don't care if there's an audience for your art or not. That's fine. But for the vast majority of people, that's just completely disheartening. And that's exactly what I'm talking about, deep psychology and deeply, deeply understanding the receptor inside a human being of the outside world. Because we need to bring back contribution for humans at the center of the debate, and it must be real. It cannot be fake.
As I was researching one of my books, Kill Process, one of the things I started looking into was the question of social isolation, which is rampant in the U.S., higher in the U.S. than anywhere else. 40% of adults do not have anyone that they can talk over their day with, their successes, or their problems. And if you exclude somebody's romantic partner, that number rises to 60%. So 60% of people don't have anyone other than a romantic partner to talk to. Which is interesting. It's mind-blowing that that number could be as high as it could, especially when you think about the fact that, you know, all those people are on social media, right? They think that they're connected, but they're not connected in any kind of meaningful way. So, you know, really the question is how do we fix this social isolation? And part of that is just a shift in recognizing it, and a shift in how we use technology to go from surface-type connections to more meaningful ones. There's really no reason we couldn't be using AI and technology to drive deeper interactions with people. You know, there's companies that are... Meetup is a great example of a company that is an online app, right, that's about getting people together in real life. There's another app that's out there that's all about fostering salon-style conversations in your living room with strangers, right? So there are people who are doing these kinds of things. We just need more of it, right? We can use the technology for whatever purposes we want, and that can include connecting with people in a meaningful way.
I have a question for Will. What are your thoughts on using AI for companionship? Is that just a crazy idea?
I don't think it's a crazy idea. Lots of people want it. Like, I've talked a lot at science fiction conventions, and if I ask people who wants to have Data from Star Trek as a fan, as a friend, like, everyone raises their hand. Like, everyone wants that person that they can talk to who's not going to judge them, who they can communicate with about whatever. Right? But it's a very funny thing. And you know, it's the same thing with, like, dating websites, right? Like, you're like, well, how can all these people be single and be complaining that they can't find a partner? Like, you're all single. Like, we're all socially isolated. We're all, you're isolated. Why aren't we just talking? The solution seems simple. But I do think that we're going to end up there. We're going to end up with part of the problem of social isolation. But it's not going to happen until we are a ways out, right? Until we get to general AI and we can really have someone meaningful to converse with. But I think we will. I think one of the great areas where it's going to be a benefit is people getting therapy, people, you know, being coached for stuff that there's lots of people inhibited about going and talking to another human being about their problems, but they will talk to a machine about it. And although that seems like a second best solution, it's still better than not talking to anybody at all.
It's been proven in Japanese retirement homes that the elderly Japanese prefer machines to human beings. So machines can be nice, apparently. This, again, is about narrative. So I think with America, I've told you about the American dreams dead and over. The other thing you need to kill is your state religion, which is called individualism. It was invented by a French autistic guy called René Descartes in 1632. Okay, and he says that I think, therefore I am. Meaning, the only thing I can trust in my life is that I exist. Okay, that's a bad idea, and it's not very human. We're tribal creatures. We're flock animals. And this is why the two words in American English that I love, and they're the two words community and congregation. Congregation is like you go somewhere at least a couple of times a week and make friends, you hang out with people, and they support you when you go through rough stuff in life. That's brilliant. Keep it. And the other thing is community. Be part of the community, be inside the community. And those 40% at least are not socially isolated in America, would probably say that they feel they belong to a congregation and they're part of a community. So that, if machines can help us with that, yes, we should be able to handle it without the machines, to be honest about it. But apparently we need to sort of reroot ourselves to understand what it means to be human and to make friends and not to look for some friend who doesn't exist somewhere else. You know, because the other end of it, of course, that the machines have also created Tinder for us. You all know what Tinder is?
Yeah.
You walk into a room and Tinder says that 30 people of various genders in this room and want to have sex with you right now. Who do you want to start with? Here's a map of the toilets. Goodbye, nuclear family. You know it. Guess I'm a Freudian, right? Sorry.
All right.
It's out the bottle.
We went from AI to Tinder. I don't know. So many here. Let's try this one. What does it mean to be human when we're no longer the pinnacle of intelligence? I've seen AI that can create beautiful music and make art, so I doubt even that creativity won't be impacted by AI. What should the next generation focus on developing?
Doing what we love now. I'm a writer. I'm a creator. I am not the pinnacle of intelligence. There are other writers out there who are better than me, there who have more thoughtful things to say. That doesn't stop me from wanting to express myself. It doesn't really matter to me if AI are out there and they vastly surpass me. I'm still going to create something meaningful to me. And if it's meaningful to even just 10 people out there, then that's worthwhile.
I call it symbiotic intelligence. I love the relationship between man and machine. We can now be more human by having machines to support us in being more human. And it's the creativity that comes out of that that's really amazing. Because the machines, after all, they're working on zeros and ones and will be for a long time. So they're working with the past. They're recycling the past and whatever they do. But we as human beings can be genuinely creative because we can comprehend things. Comprehension is something that machines do not understand. It's fundamentally human. And I'm more and more interested in what makes us different from the machines. Technologies will tell us what the machines can do. But I'm really all for a revival of human because we can afford to revive being human and then go into a relationship between man and machine that can create the most amazing things together. Symbiotic intelligence is the word for that.
Yeah, I'm very supportive of that idea of symbiotic intelligence. But I want to question the assumption of the question a bit, like in the sense that in most of these cases where AI has surpassed human performance, here's what's actually happened. A human has designed that algorithm, and importantly, a human has selected the output from that algorithm that actually gets shown, right? And the role of human as critic is often underestimated in these cases, right? And what I look forward to is, instead of either or, I really think this can be and. And some of the best AI in terms of creativity enhancement that I've seen is things like where you have a jazz jam session and one other jam, like one other musical instrument, is an AI. So then the ideas go backwards and forwards between the human and the machine, enhancing each one's performance. And if you go and watch some of these, it's kind of amazing. One more example is, a while ago, a machine beat humans at Go, right? And this is something that nobody expected, right? Like, AI went through this sudden burst, and Tom Dietrich, who's one of the experts in the field, say, this is not something I expected to see in my lifetime. After that, they interviewed Lisa Dole, who's the human that was beaten. And what he said is, I'm really excited by this. And they asked him why. And he said, well, because now we can both play better Go than either one of us would be able to play alone. Right, by the machine giving him suggestions and ideas that he would not have thought of, and him giving the machine corrections and suggestions, that allowed us to become like more than any one of either the AI or the human can be. And that's another reason that I'm really excited about AI, as an amplifier of human creativity, not just as an adjunct or alternative to it.
We just saw that in the last World Chess Championship contest between this American Indian and the Norwegian guy, right? We all know machines kill humans at chess, right? They've done it for the last 30 years. It's easy for the machines to beat humans at chess. It's less complicated than Go. But still, this final this last year was huge online. People watched it. And they knew these guys have turned off their machines. They're only working with their own minds and their meaning. And the beauty of human chess was a bit like going to a ladies' football game. It's just like, okay, you go to soccer game, the guys are going to be better because they're physically bigger. Technically, the guys will be better. But you can go to a ladies' soccer game and enjoy it because ladies play soccer different from what men do. So the beauty of it is when humans then play chess, being trained by machines, compared to when the machines play chess, which is just boring because it's just calculation, right? It's just which machine is the fastest. Which humans, it's like a dance between two humans. And this, again, illustrates that we are very, very adept at actually go to what's human and love it and understanding what's machinic about our world and what's symbiotic in between. We can easily adapt to these three categories. So I'm very hopeful in that department.
And moreover, nobody has stopped playing chess just because machines are better at it, right?
No.
People still play it and get joy out of it. It doesn't matter. They don't have to be the best chess player in the world to enjoy playing chess.
And more girls play soccer than ever. There you go.
Yeah.
Okay, here's an interesting one. It would appear the biggest issue facing the 80% is their ignorance. How can AI improve human education?
Oh, but that's such an elitist question. Please. Why did you have to put ignorance into that question? That's so degrading. Come on. Yeah, a lot of people will find it difficult to follow. This is a huge technological revolution that's happening at breakneck speed. What always happened when that happened previously is that eventually the winners turned around and said, can we help the losers? That's where you created the nation state in the 19th century. The last massive, really great project like that was mass education that started in Germany and Scandinavia in the 1840s and was adopted in Britain and America only a few years later. So you put all the kids in school, so you taught all the kids to read and write and count. Now, it's going to be a lot more difficult this time around. But stop being elitist against the losers in this society. It's sickening. Stop. Just stop it. They're humans. They deserve respect. Ignorance is the wrong word.
All right. Anybody else? All right. Let's see here. I have a student question.
Can I go back to that question?
Yeah.
I'm going to take a slight different spin on that, right? The cost of college education is astronomical in our country. And many, many people, right, can't afford it, or if they can afford it, it cripples them for a very long time. And I think we definitely have the opportunity. I mean, we're already seeing, you know, this sort of crowdsourcing of knowledge at creating alternative ways to learn. And I think we're just going to continue to see more of that, and I think AI can augment that so that learning can be better customized to the person learning. So if there was anything that I was going to bet on, it would be that the university system would not look anything like it does in 15 years. Uh-huh. That we're going to see vastly more people being taught by AI and foregoing a traditional college education. And whether or not that ends up being accredited in some way and recognized, or whether that's just what people do because that's what they can afford, I think we are going to see that change.
Yeah, and just to add a little bit to that, like just as a poll quickly, who here has had something that they wanted to learn and then gone to YouTube to find the answer? Right, like I want you to think back 15 years before YouTube, how you actually learn stuff, right? So like for me, I just wanted to get into woodworking a while ago. I would have done a course, and maybe this also contributes to the social isolation dimension, but the capability of new media to help us learn is just phenomenal. And now imagine that enhanced with extreme personalization, right? So every question you answer, the machine kind of looks at it and goes, maybe this is the conceptual flaw that this person has that's stopping them from getting to the next step, right? So there's a possibility. One of the beauties of AI is its potential to be used for extremely personalized experience. Now, there is a risk of isolation, of course, but it can accelerate things massively, and we've already started to see that shift. And the cool thing is, you know, when you use things like YouTube, again, AI is there going, hi, you're interested in this type of thing for woodworking. And so it becomes much more of a joyous experience, right? It's kind of like, oh, well, I can learn that too, and I can learn that too. And there too, I think that's somewhere where I think AI has the power to encourage curiosity in a positive way, and I'm hopeful about that.
I would say the household robots you got today, in a few years' time, they will teach your kids more stuff before those kids are 7 years old than they will learn at school before they're 15. Alexa, Siri, all of them will be teachers. And they'll be all be interconnected with each other, so they'll be better and better and better and better teaching every day that happens. This is exactly the beauty of machine intelligence when it really works. That also means, okay, next 10 years, huge crisis for colleges and universities in America. William just pointed it out. Any sector of the economy that's terribly expensive and thinks it will survive forever, charging people fortunes, it's a perfect takeover area for tech startups. Meaning, as soon as we start accepting you actually get a better education than Harvard online, meaning you have to go to Harvard online and you can live anywhere in the world, and you just go to a test center and check that out every 12 months, and you do it in a much more affordable way than having to go to Harvard, then millions of people can go to Harvard. It means that all the smaller colleges out there that don't have much of a name, they're going to die. I'll give you an example. I was in Marrakesh in Morocco and interviewed smart Moroccan schoolgirls or university girls like a couple of months ago. And none of them went to class any longer. None of them. And they had perfect grades. They spoke perfect English, Spanish, Arabic, and French. Cool girls with hijabs on, 20 years old, ready to take over the world. They're really cool girls, right? And I just asked them, so you don't go to class any longer? No, we don't go to class any longer. And they felt guilty about it because the classrooms were all with male professors who were over 50 years old, who were standing now in empty classrooms with not a single student. And I just asked the girls, so where do you learn everything? YouTube. They've got YouTube in Morocco, and they've got the best lectures in the world. And they speak English, French, and Spanish, and Arabic fluently. So they learn from all these guys, and then they go and do the test, and they get top scores. They're clever girls. Now, I just asked them, why do you need to go to the university in the first place? Well, my mother would be upset if I wasn't here. Okay? That's a perfect tech startup takeover sector right now, next 10 years. Watch out for it.
The other thing, to go back to the question of the isolation, is this is again another opportunity where we can match human capacity with human demand. So if you want to learn woodworking and we're in a, you know, a universal basic income and people aren't working because there's unemployment, there's someone out there who wants to teach you woodworking, for whom, you know, to spend their day teaching you something would make them very happy, and you'll be very happy learning it, right? So we can, again, be using technology to match people up that way.
And on that optimistic note, I would like to thank our panelists, our esteemed panelists, for their contributions today. Thank you. Thank you to the audience. Thank you for coming to the Conference on World Affairs. And thank you for your attention today.